98% today, see Appendix B. There can be no doubt that this symbiosis was mutualistic, fitness-enhancing to both parties. What I now want to suggest is that, alongside the domestication of animals and plants, there was a gradual process in which the wild, self-sustaining memes of folk religion became thoroughly domesticated. They acquired stewards. Memes that are fortunate enough to have stewards, people who will work hard and use their intelligence to foster their propagation and protect them from their enemies, are relieved of much of the burden of keeping their own lineages going. In extreme cases, they no longer need to be particularly catchy or appeal to our sensual instincts at all. The multiplication table memes, for instance, to say nothing of the calculus memes, are hardly crowd-pleasers, and yet they are duly propagated by hard-working teachers, meme shepherds, whose responsibility it is to keep these lineages strong. The wild memes of language and folk religion, in other words, are like rats and squirrels, pigeons and cold viruses, magnificently adapted to living with us and exploiting us whether we like them or not. The domesticated memes, in contrast, depend on help from human guardians to keep going. People have been poring over their religious practices and institutions for almost as long as they have been refining their agricultural practices and institutions, and these reflective examiners have all had agendas, individual or shared conceptions of what was valuable and why. Some have been wise and some foolish, some widely informed and some naive, some pure and saintly and some venal and vicious. Jared Diamond's hypothesis about the practically exhaustive search by our ancestors for domesticatable species in their neighborhoods, discussed in Chapter 5, can be extended. Curious practitioners will also have uncovered whatever good tricks are in the nearest neighborhoods in the design space of possible religions. Diamond sees the transition from bands of fewer than 100 people to tribes of hundreds to chiefdoms of thousands to states of over 50,000 people as an inexorable march from egalitarianism to kleptocracy, government by thieves. Speaking of chiefdoms, he remarks, "At best, they do good by providing expensive services impossible to contract for on an individual basis. At worst, they function unabashedly as kleptocracies, transferring that wealth from commoners to upper classes. Why do the commoners tolerate the transfer of the fruits of their hard labor to kleptocrats?" This question, raised by political theorists from Plato to Marx, is raised anew by voters in every modern election. 1997, page 276. There are four ways, he suggests, that kleptocrats have tried to maintain their power. One, disarm the populace and arm the elite. Two, make the masses happy by redistributing much of the tribute received. Three, use the monopoly of force to promote happiness by maintaining public order and curbing violence. Or four, construct an ideology or religion justifying kleptocracy, page 277. How might a religion support a kleptocracy? By an alliance between the political leader and the priests, of course, in which, first of all, the leader is declared to be divine, or descended from the gods, or, as Diamond puts it, at least having a hotline to the gods. Besides justifying the transfer of wealth to kleptocrats, institutionalized religion brings two other important benefits to centralized societies. First, shared ideology or religion helps solve the problem of how unrelated individuals are to live together without killing each other, by providing them with a bond not based on kinship. Second, it gives people a motive, other than genetic self-interest, for sacrificing their lives on behalf of others. At the cost of a few society members who die in battle as soldiers, the whole society becomes much more effective at conquering other societies or resisting attacks, page 278. So we find the same devices invented over and over again, in just about every religion, and many non-religious organizations as well. None of this is new today. As Lord Acton said more than a century ago, all power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But it was new once upon a time when our ancestors were first exploring design revisions to our most potent institutions. For instance, accepting inferior status to an invisible god is a cunning stratagem, whether or not its cunning is consciously recognized by those who stumble upon it. Those who rely on it will thrive, wittingly or otherwise. As every subordinate knows, one's commands are more effective than they might otherwise be if one can accompany them with a threat to tell the bigger boss if disobedience ensues. Variations on this stratagem are well known to mafia underlings and used car salesmen, among others. I myself am not authorized to make such an offer, so I'll have to check with my boss. Excuse me for a minute. This helps to explain what is otherwise a bit of a puzzle. Any dictator depends on the fidelity of his immediate staff, in the simple sense that any two or three of them could easily overpower him. He can't go around with dagger drawn all his life. How do you, as a dictator, ensure that your immediate staff puts its fidelity to you above any thoughts they may very well have about replacing you? Putting the fear of a higher power in their heads is a pretty good move. There is often, no doubt, an unspoken détente between chief priest and king. Each needs the other for his power, and together they need the gods above. Walter Burkert is particularly Machiavellian in his account of how this stratagem brings the institution of ritual praise in its wake, and notes some of its useful complexity. By the force of his verbal competence, the priest not only rises to a superior level in imagination, but succeeds in reversing the attention structure. It is the superior who is made to pay heed to the inferior song or speech of praise. Praise is the recognized form of making noise in the presence of superiors. In a well-structured form, it tends to become music. Praise ascends to the heights like incense. Thus, the tension between high and low is both stressed and relaxed. As the lower one establishes his place within a system, he accepts emphatically. 1996, page 91. The gods will get you if you try to cross either one of us. We have already noted the role of rituals, both individual rehearsals and unison error absorption sessions, in enhancing the fidelity of mimetic transmission, and noted that these are enforced by making non-participation costly in one way or another. Moreover, as Joseph Bulbulia suggests, it may be that religious rituals put on display the natural power of a religious community, an awesome show to potential defectors of what they are up against, 2004, page 40. But what drives the community spirit in the first place? Is the project of keeping groups united mainly just a matter of kleptocrats inventing ways of keeping their sheep? Or is there a more benign story to uncover? Chapter 6. The transmission of religion has been attended by voluminous revision, often deliberate and foresighted, as people become stewards of the ideas that had entered them, domesticating them. Secrecy, deception, and systematic invulnerability to disconfirmation are some of the features that have emerged, and these have been designed by processes that were sensitive to new answers to the cui bono question, as the steward's motives entered the process. Chapter 7. Why do people join groups? Is this simply a rational decision on their part, or are there relatively mindless forms of group selection at work? Though there is much to be said in favor of both of these proposals, they do not exhaust the plausible models that attempt to explain our readiness to form lasting allegiances. Chapter 7. The Invention of Team Spirit. 1. A Path Paved with Good Intentions. And here comes the catch. Only a bad person needs to repent. Only a good person can repent perfectly. The worse you are, the more you need it, and the less you can do it. The only person who could do it perfectly would be a perfect person, and he would not need it. C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity. Every control system, whether it is an animal nervous system, a plant's system of growth and self-repair, or an engineered artifact such as an airplane guidance system, is designed to protect something. And that something must include itself. If it dies prematurely, it fails on its mission, whatever it is. The self-interest that thus defines the evaluation machinery of all control systems can splinter, however, when a control system gets reflective. Our human reflectiveness opens up a rich field of opportunities for us to revise our aims, including our largest purposes. When you can start to think about the pros and cons of joining an existing coalition versus breaking away and trying to start a new one, or about how to deal with the problems of loyalty among your kin, or the need to change the power structure of your social environment, You create avenues by which to escape the default presumptions of your initial design. Whenever an agent, an intentional system in my terminology, makes a decision about the best course of action, all things considered, we can ask from whose perspective this optimality is being judged. A more or less standard default assumption, at least in the Western world, and especially among economists, is to treat each human agent as a sort of isolated and individualistic locus of well-being, what's in it for me, rational self-interest. But although there has to be something in the role of the self, something that answers the cui bono question for the decision-maker under examination, there is no necessity in this default treatment, common as it is. A self as ultimate beneficiary can in principle be indefinitely distributed in space and time. I can care for others or for a larger social structure, for instance. There is nothing that restricts me to a me as contrasted to an us. I can still take my task to be looking out for number one while including under number one not just myself and not just my family, but also Islam or Oxfam or the Chicago Bulls. The possibility opened up by cultural evolution of installing such novel perspectives in our brains is what gives our species, and only our species, the capacity for moral and immoral thinking. Here is a well-known trajectory. You begin with a heartfelt desire to help other people and the conviction, however well or ill-founded, that your guild or club or church is the coalition that can best serve to improve the welfare of others. If times are particularly tough, this conditional stewardship, I'm doing what's good for the guild because that will be good for everybody, may be displaced by the narrower concern for the integrity of the guild itself. And for good reason. If you believe that the institution in question is the best path to goodness, the goal of preserving it for future projects, still unimagined, can be the most rational higher goal you can define. It is a short step from this to losing track of or even forgetting the larger purpose and devoting yourself single-mindedly to furthering the interests of the institution, at whatever costs. A conditional or instrumental allegiance can thus become indistinguishable in practice from a commitment to something good in itself. A further short step perverts this parochial summum bonum to the more selfish goal of doing whatever it takes to keep yourself at the helm of the institution. Who better than I to lead us to triumph over our adversaries? We have all seen this happen many times, and may even have caught ourselves in the act of forgetting just why we wanted to be leaders in the first place. Such transitions bring conscious decision-making to bear on issues that had previously been tracked by the foresightless process of differential replication by natural selection, of memes or of genes. And this creates new rivals as answers to the cui bono question. What is good, all things considered, may not coincide with what is good for the institution, which may not be what makes life easiest for the institution's leader. But these different benchmarks have a way of being substituted for one another under the pressure of real-time reflective control. When this happens, the free-floating rationales that are blindly sculpted by earlier competitions can come to be augmented or even replaced by represented rationales, rationales that are not just anchored in individual minds, in diagrams and plans, and in conversations, but used, argued over, reasoned about, agreed upon. People thus become conscious stewards of their memes, no longer taking their survival for granted the way we take our language for granted, but taking on the goal of fostering, protecting, enhancing, spreading the word. Why do people want to be stewards of their religions? It is obvious, isn't it? They believe that this is the way to lead a moral life, a good life, and they sincerely want to be good. Are they right? Notice that this is not the question of whether religions have enhanced human biological fitness. Biological fitness and moral value are entirely different issues. I have postponed the fitness question until we could see that, although it is a good empirical question, a question that we ought to try to answer, answering it will still leave wide open the question about whether we ought to be stewards of religion. With that point firmly established, let us at last consider, not answer, the question of whether, in the end, folk religions and the organized religions they have morphed into have conferred fitness benefits on those who practice them. This question has preoccupied anthropologists and other researchers for centuries, often because they confused it with the question of the ultimate moral value of religion. And there is no dearth of familiar hypotheses to explore once we've cleared the decks. Two of the most plausible will receive further attention in later chapters, so for now I will just acknowledge them. Dunbar, 2004, summarizes one of them well. It is surely no accident that almost every religion promises its adherents that they, and they alone, are the chosen of God, guaranteed salvation no matter what, assured that the Almighty, or whatever form the gods take, will assist them through their current difficulties if the right rituals and prayers are performed. This undoubtedly introduces a profound sense of comfort in times of adversity. Page 191. Notice that comfort in and of itself would not be a fitness booster unless it also provided, as it almost certainly does, the practical advantages of resolution and confidence in both decision-making and action. May the force be with you. When you are faced with the often terrifying uncertainty of a dangerous world, the belief that somebody is watching over you may well be a decisively effective morale booster, capable of turning people who would otherwise be disabled by fear and indecision into stalwart agents. This is a hypothesis about individual effectiveness in times of strife, and it may or may not be true. An entirely distinct hypothesis is that participation in religion, in harrowing initiation rites, for instance, creates or strengthens bonds of trust that permit groups of individuals to act together much more effectively. Versions of this group fitness hypothesis have been advanced by Boyer, Burkert, Wilson, and many others. It may or may not be true. Indeed, both hypotheses could be true, and we should try to confirm or disconfirm them both, if only for the light they will shed, no more, on the question of the moral value of religion. 2. The ant colony and the corporation. Religions exist primarily for people to achieve together what they cannot achieve alone. David Sloan Wilson, Darwin's Cathedral. But what are the benefits? Why do people want religion at all? They want it because religion is the only plausible source of certain rewards for which there is a general and inexhaustible demand. Rodney Stark and Roger Fink, Acts of Faith. Why do people join groups? Because they want to. But why do they want to? For many reasons, including the obvious, for mutual protection and economic security, to promote efficiency of harvesting and other necessary activities to accomplish large-scale projects that would otherwise be impossible. But the manifest utility of these group arrangements does not in itself explain how they ever came to pass, for there are barriers to overcome in the form of mutual fear and hostility and the always looming prospect of opportunistic defection or betrayal. Our inability to achieve truly global cooperation in spite of persuasive arguments demonstrating the benefits to be had, and in spite of many failed campaigns intended to create enabling institutions, shows that the limited cooperation and loyalty we do enjoy is a rare achievement. We have somehow managed to civilize ourselves to some degree in ways no other species has ever attempted, so far as we can tell. Other species often form populations that cluster together in herds or flocks or schools, and it is clear why these groupings, when they occur, are adaptive. But we are not grazing animals, for instance, and among the foraging and predating apes that are our nearest animal relatives, the largest stable groups are generally restricted to close kin, extended families into which newcomers are admitted only after a struggle and a test. Among chimpanzees, the newcomers are always females, emigrating from their home groups to find mates. Any male that tried to join another group would be summarily killed. There is no mystery about why we, like other apes, would have evolved a craving for the company of conspecifics, but that instinct for gregariousness has its limits. It is remarkable that we have learned to be comfortable in the company of strangers, as Seabright, 2004, puts it. And a perennially persuasive idea about religion is that it works to promote just such group cohesiveness, turning otherwise hapless populations of unrelated and mutually suspicious people into tightly knit families or even highly effective superorganisms, rather like ant colonies or beehives. The impressive solidarity achieved by many religious organizations is not in doubt, but could this explain the rise and continued existence of religions? Many have thought so, but just how could this work? Theorists of all persuasions agree that the R&D required to set up and maintain such a system has to be accomplished somehow. And there seem at first to be just two paths to choose between: the ant colony route and the corporation route. Natural selection has shaped the design of ants over the eons, tooling the individual ant types into specialists that automatically coordinate their efforts so that a normally harmonious and vigorous colony results. There were no heroic individual ants who figured it out and implemented it. They didn't have to, since natural selection did all the trial and error for them. And there is not now, and never was, any individual ant, or council of ants, to play the role of governor. In contrast, it is precisely the rational choices of individual human beings that bring a corporation into existence. They design the structure, agree to incorporate, and then govern its activities. Individual rational agents, looking out for their own interests and doing their own individual cost-benefit analyses, make the decisions that shape, directly or indirectly, the features of the corporation. Is the robustness of a religion, its ability to persevere and thrive in defiance of the second law of thermodynamics, like the robustness of an ant colony or a corporation? Is religion the product of blind evolutionary instinct or rational choice? Or is there some other possibility? Might it be a gift from God, for instance? The failure to ask, let alone answer this question, is the charge that has long been used to discredit the functionalist school of sociology initiated by Emil Durkheim. According to its critics, functionalists treated societies as if they were living things, maintaining their health and vigor by a host of adjustments in their organs, without showing how the R&D required to design and adjust these superorganisms was accomplished. This criticism is especially the same criticism aimed by evolutionary biologists at the Gaia hypothesis of Lovelock, 1979, and others. According to the Gaia hypothesis, Earth's biosphere is itself a sort of superorganism, maintaining its various balances in order to preserve life on Earth. A pretty idea, but, as Richard Dawkins succinctly puts it, for the analogy to apply strictly, there would have to have been a set of rival Gaias, presumably on different planets. Biospheres which did not develop efficient homeostatic regulations of their planetary atmospheres tended to go extinct. In addition, we would have to postulate some kind of reproduction, whereby successful planets spawned copies of their life forms on new planets. 1982-1999, page 236. Gaia enthusiasts, if they want to be taken seriously, have to ask and answer the question of how the presumed homeostatic systems got designed and installed. Functionalists in the social sciences must assume the same burden. Enter David Sloan Wilson, 2002, and his multi-level selection theory to try to save the day for a brand of functionalism by grounding the design process in the same R&D algorithms that account for the rest of the biosphere. According to Wilson, the design innovations that work systematically to bind human groups together are the result of Darwinian descent, with modification guided by differential replication of the most fit at many levels, including the group level. In short, he accepts the challenge of showing that competition between rival groups led to the extinction of the ill-designed groups in failing competition with the better-designed groups, which were beneficiaries of free-floating rationales, to put it my way, that none of their members needed to understand. Cui bono, the fitness of the group must trump the individual fitness of its members. And if groups are going to be the ultimate beneficiaries, groups must be the competitors. Selection can go on at several levels at once, however, thanks to competitions at several levels. Critics have long scoffed at the functionalists' invocation of something like mystical societal wisdom, like the imagined wisdom of Gaia. But Wilson is right to insist that there need be nothing mystical or even mysterious about Durkheimian group-friendly functions getting installed by evolutionary processes, if he can demonstrate group selection processes. The distributed wisdom of an ant colony, which really is a sort of superorganism, has been analyzed in depth and detail by evolutionary biologists, and there is no doubt that evolutionary processes can shape group adaptations under special conditions, like those that prevail among the social insects. But people aren't ants, or very much like ants, and only the most regimented religious orders approach the fascistic lockstep of the social insects. Human minds are hugely complex exploration devices, corrosive questioners of every detail of the world they encounter, so evolution had better add some remarkable bells and whistles to its adaptations for human groupishness if there is to be any chance of success by the group selection route. Wilson thinks that competition between religious groups with differential survival and replication of some of those groups can generate, and pay for, the excellent design features we observe in religions. The opposite theoretical pole, the only alternative, or so it first appears, is occupied by the rational choice theorists, who have recently arisen to challenge the widespread presumption by social scientists that religion is some kind of lunacy. As Rodney Stark and Roger Fink, 2000, note with scorn, for more than three centuries, the standard social scientific wisdom was that religious behavior must be irrational precisely because people do make sacrifices on behalf of their faith, since obviously no rational person would do such a thing, page 42. But as they insist, one need not be a religious person in order to grasp the underlying rationality of religious behavior, any more than one need be a criminal in order to impute rationality to many deviant acts, as the leading theories of crime and deviance do. What we are saying is that religious behavior, to the degree that it occurs, is generally based on cost-benefit calculations, and is therefore rational behavior in precisely the same sense that other human behavior is rational. Page 36. Religions are indeed like corporations, they claim. Religious organizations are social enterprises whose purpose is to create, maintain, and supply religion to some set of individuals and to support and supervise their exchanges with a god or gods. Page 103. Demand for the goods that religion has to offer is inelastic. In a free market of religious choice, as in the United States, with no state religion and many competing denominations, there is vigorous competition among denominations for market dominance, a straightforward application of supply-side economics. But as Wilson notes in a useful comparison between his theory and theirs, even if we were to grant that now it is rational for church members to make what are basically market decisions about which religion to invest in, an assumption we will soon examine, this doesn't answer the question about R&D. But how did the religion acquire its structure that adaptively constrains the choices of utility maximizers in just the right way? We must explain the structure of the religion in addition to the behavior of individuals once the structure is in place. Were the bizarre customs consciously invented by rational actors attempting to maximize their utilities? If so, why did they have the utility of maximizing the common good of their church? Must we really attribute all adaptive features of a religion to a psychological process of cost-benefit reasoning? Isn't a process of blind variation and selective retention possible? After all, thousands of religions are born and die without notice because they never attract more than a few members. Stark and Bainbridge, 1985. Perhaps the adaptive features of the few that survive are like random mutations rather than the product of rational choice. Page 82. Wilson is right to stress the alternative of a blind variation and selective retention process, but by clinging to his radical group selection version, he misses a better opportunity. The evolutionary design process that has given us religions involves the differential replication of memes, not groups. Wilson briefly mentions this as an alternative, but dismisses it with hardly a glance, largely because he views its defining doctrine to be that religious features must be dysfunctional. He thinks the meme theory requires that all religious memes be fitness-reducing parasites and seldom, if ever, fitness-neutral commensals or fitness-enhancing mutualists. Here Wilson is led astray by a common misunderstanding. Richard Dawkins, who coined the term meme, is no particular friend of religion and has often likened memes, religious memes in particular, to viruses, stressing the capacity of memes to proliferate in spite of their deleterious effects on their human hosts. Although this jarring claim needs to be considered as a major possibility, we should not forget that the vast majority of memes, like the vast majority of bacterial and viral symbionts that inhabit our bodies, are neutral, or even helpful, from the perspective of host fitness. Here, then, is my mild mimetic alternative to Wilson's group-level hypothesis. Memes that foster human group solidarity are particularly fit, as memes, in circumstances in which host survival, and hence host fitness, most directly depends on hosts joining forces in groups. The success of such meme-infested groups is itself a potent broadcasting device, enhancing out-group curiosity and envy, and thus permitting linguistic, ethnic, and geographic boundaries to be more readily penetrated. Like Wilson's more radical group selection theory, this hypothesis can, in principle, account for the excellence of design encountered in religion without postulating rational designers, the religion-as-corporation route. And it can account for the fact that individual fitness is apparently subordinated to group fitness in religions. According to this theory, we don't need to postulate group replication tournaments, but only a cultural environment in which ideas compete. Ideas that encourage people to act together in groups, the way Toxoplasma gondii encourages rats to approach cats fearlessly, will spread more effectively as a result of this groupishness than ideas that do a less effective job of uniting their hosts into armies. Using the meme's eye view, we can unite the two opposite poles of theory, ant colony versus corporation, and explain the R&D of human groupishness as a mixture of blind and foresighted processes, including intermediate selection processes of every flavor of knowingness. Since people are not like ants, but really quite rational, they are unlikely to be encouraged to invest heavily in group activities unless they perceive, or think they perceive, benefits worth the investment. Hence, the ideas that maximize groupishness will be those that appeal, just as Stark and Fink say, to rewards for which there is a general and inexhaustible demand. An unexpected bonus of this unified perspective is that it makes elbow room for an intermediate position on the status of religion that modifies one of the most troubling features of the rational choice model. Stark and Fink and the other rational choice theorists of religion like to portray themselves as defenders of those with religious faith, saying, in effect, they're not crazy, they're smart. However, this deliberately cold-blooded rational analysis of the market for religious goods deeply offends many religious people. They don't want to see themselves as cannily making a sound investment in the most effective purveyor of supernatural benefits. They want to see themselves as having set aside all such selfish considerations, as having relinquished their rational control to a higher power. The meme theory accounts for this. According to this theory, the ultimate beneficiaries of religious adaptations are the memes themselves. But their proliferation, in competition with rival memes, depends on their ability to attract hosts one way or another. Once allegiance is captured, a host is turned into a rational servant. But the initial capture need not be, indeed should not be, a rational choice by the host. Memes sometimes need to be gently inserted into their new homes, overcoming rational resistance by encouraging a certain passivity or receptivity in the host. William James, a memeticist ahead of his time, notes the importance of this feature for some religions, and usefully draws our attention to a secular counterpart, the music teacher who admonishes the student, "Stop trying and it will do itself," 1902, page 206. Just let go and clear your mind and let that little information packet, that little habit recipe, take over. One may say that the whole development of Christianity in inwardness has consisted in little more than the greater and greater emphasis attached to this crisis of self-surrender, pages 210 to 11. Were we writing the story of the mind from the purely natural history point of view, with no religious intent whatever, we should still have to write down man's liability to sudden and complete conversion as one of his most curious peculiarities, page 230. It is worth recalling that the Arabic word Islam means submission. The idea that Muslims should put the proliferation of Islam ahead of their own interests is built right into the etymology of its name, and Islam is not alone. What is more important to devout Christians than their own well-being, than their own lives, if it comes to that? They will tell you the word. Spreading the word of God is their summum bonum. And if they are called upon to forego having children and grandchildren for the sake of spreading the word, that is the command they will try hard to obey. They do not shrink from the idea that a meme has commandeered them and obtunded their reproductive instinct. They embrace it. And they declare that this is precisely what distinguishes them from mere animals. It gives them a value to pursue that transcends the genetic imperative that limits the decision horizon of all other species. In the pursuit of that value, however, they will be as rational as they can be. When they look out for number one is the word, not their own skin, let alone their selfish genes. No ant can put itself in the service of a word. It doesn't have language or any culture to speak of. We language users get not just one word, but many, however, and the many words compete for our attention, and in combination, these can form coalitions that vie for our allegiance. This is where rational choice theory comes into its own. For, as we have seen, once people are turned into stewards of their own favorite memes, an arms race of would-be improvements ensues. All design work is ultimately a matter of trial and error, but a lot of it takes place offline, in representations of decisions in the minds of people who consider them carefully, before deciding for real on what they think will work best, given their limited information about the cruel world in which the designs must ultimately be tested. Thinking it through is quicker and cheaper than running the trials in the world, and letting nature do the winnowing. But the human foresight that provides the extra speed is fallible and biased, so we often make mistakes. Mimetic engineering, like genetic engineering, can spawn monsters if we're not careful, and if they escape the laboratory, they may proliferate in spite of our best efforts. We always need to remember Orgel's second rule. Evolution is cleverer than you are. Permit me to pause here for a moment and point out what we have just done. The ardent anti-Darwinians in the humanities and social sciences have traditionally feared that an evolutionary approach would drown their cherished way of thinking, with its heroic authors and artists and inventors and other defenders and lovers of ideas. And so they have tended to declare, with desperate conviction but no evidence or argument, that human culture and human society can only be interpreted and never causally explained, using methods and presuppositions that are completely incommensurable with or untranslatable into the methods and presuppositions of the natural sciences. You can't get here from there, could be their motto. The chasm is unbridgeable. And yet we have just completed a sketchy but non-miraculous and matter-of-fact stroll all the way from blind, mechanical, robotic nature to the passionate defense and elaboration of the most exalted ideas known to humankind. The chasm was a figment of fearful imagination. We can do a better job of understanding ourselves as champions of ideas and defenders of values if we first see how we came to occupy such a special role. Once there are alternatives on offer in the marketplace of ideas, bigger and better rivals compete for allegiance, including not just mutating religions, but, eventually, secular institutions as well. Among the coalitions not based on genetic kinship that have thrived in recent human history are political parties, revolutionary groups, ethnic organizations, labor unions, sports teams, and, last but not least, the mafia. The dynamics of group membership, entrance and exit conditions, loyalty, and its enforcement by punishment or otherwise, have been intensively studied in recent years by evolutionary thinkers in a variety of disciplines. Economics, political science, cognitive psychology, biology, and, of course, philosophy. The results shed light on cooperation and altruism in secular as well as religious contexts, and this helps highlight the features that distinguish religious organizations from others. 3. The growth market in religion. Proposition 75. To the degree that religious economies are unregulated and competitive, overall levels of religious participation will be high. Conversely, lacking competition, the dominant firms will be too inefficient to sustain vigorous marketing efforts, and the results will be a low overall level of religious participation, with the average person minimizing and delaying payment of religious costs. Rodney Stark and Roger Fink, Acts of Faith. In every aspect of the religious life, American faith has met American culture, and American culture has triumphed. Alan Wolfe, The Transformation of American Religion. We have a better product than soap or automobiles. We have eternal life. Reverend Jim Baker. Why make great sacrifices in order to further the prospects of a religious organization? Why, for instance, might one choose loyalty to a religion when one is also perhaps a contributing member of a labor union, a political party, and a social club? These why questions start by being neutral between two quite different types of answers. They could be asking why it is rational to choose loyalty to a religion, or they could be asking why it is natural, somehow, for people to be drawn into a religion which then commands their loyalty. Consider the question, why do so many people fear heights? One answer is because it is rational to fear heights. You can fall and hurt yourself. Another is, we have evolved an instinctual caution triggered by the perception that we are exposed at a great height. In some people, this anxiety is exaggerated beyond what is useful. Their fear is natural. We can explain its existence without residual mystery, but irrational. If we take a good hard look at the first answer regarding religion as proposed by rational choice theory, it will help us see the forces and constraints that shape the alternatives. Over the last two decades, Rodney Stark and his colleagues have done a remarkable job of articulating the rational choice answer. And they claim that, thanks to their efforts, it now is impossible to do credible work in the social scientific study of religion based on the assumption that religiousness is a sign of stupidity, neurosis, poverty, ignorance, or false consciousness, or represents a flight from modernity. Stark and Fink, 2000, page 18. They concentrate on religion in the USA, and their basic model is a straightforward application of economic theory. Indeed, having now had more than two centuries to develop under free market conditions, the American religious economy surpasses Adam Smith's wildest dreams about the creative forces of a free market. Moore, 1994. There are more than 1,500 separate religious denominations. Melton, 1998. Many of them very sizable. 24 have more than 1 million members each. Each of these bodies is entirely dependent on voluntary contributions. And American religious donations currently total more than $60 billion per year, or more than $330 per person over age 18. These totals omit many contributions to church construction funds. New church construction amounted to $3 billion in 1993, as well as most donations to religious schools, hospitals, and foreign missions. In 1996, more than $2.3 billion was donated to support missionaries, and a significant amount of this was spent on missionaries to Europe. Page 223. H.L. Mencken once opined, "The only really respectable Protestants are the fundamentalists. Unfortunately, they are also palpable idiots." Many share that opinion, especially in academia, but not Stark and Fink. They are particularly eager to dispel the familiar idea that the more fundamentalist or evangelical the denomination is, the less rational it is. Among the more common suggestions as to why evangelical churches grow are repressed sexuality, divorce, urbanization, racism, sexism, status anxieties, and rapid social change. Never do proponents of the old paradigm even explore possible religious explanations. For example, that people are drawn to the evangelical churches by a superior product. Page 30. People bear the heavy expenses of church membership, and the church in return contracts to support and supervise their exchanges with a god or gods. Page 103. Stark and Fink have worked this out carefully, and their driving premise is their Proposition 6. In pursuit of rewards, humans will seek to utilize and manipulate the supernatural. Page 90. Some people go it alone, but most think they need help, and that is what churches provide. Do churches actually manipulate the supernatural? Are Stark and Fink committed to the claim that exchanges with a god or gods really occur? No, they are studiously agnostic, or so they claim, on this score. They often point out that it can be perfectly rational to invest in a stock that turns out to be worthless after all. In a later book, One True God, Historical Consequences of Monotheism, 2001, Stark takes on the role of mimetic engineer, analyzing the pros and cons of doctrine as if he were an advertising consultant. What sorts of gods have the greatest appeal? Page 2. Here he distinguishes two strategies, God as essence, such as Tillich's God as the ground of all being, entirely non-anthropomorphic, not in time and space abstract, and God as conscious supernatural being. A God who listens to and answers prayers in real time, for instance. There is no more profound religious difference than that between faiths involving divine beings and those limited to divine essences, he says, and the latter he judges to be hopeless, because only divine beings do anything. Page 10. supernatural conscious beings are much better sellers because the supernatural is the only plausible source of many benefits we greatly desire, page 12. People care about gods because if they exist, they are potential exchange partners possessed of immense resources. Furthermore, untold billions of people are certain that gods do exist, precisely because they believe they have experienced long and satisfying exchange relations with them, page 13. Because gods are conscious beings, they are potential exchange partners because all beings are assumed to want something for which they might be induced to give something valuable, page 15. He adds that a responsive fatherly god makes an extremely attractive exchange partner who can be counted on to maximize human benefits, page 21. And he even proposes that a god without a counterbalancing Satan is an unstable concept, irrational and perverse. Why? Because one god of infinite scope must be responsible for everything, evil as well as good, and thus must be dangerously capricious, shifting intentions unpredictably and without reason, page 24. This is pretty much the same raison d'etre that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman, appreciated when they invented kryptonite, as something to counteract the Man of Steel. There is no drama possible, no defeats to overcome, no cliffhangers if your hero is too powerful. But, unlike the concepts of kryptonite, these concepts of God and Satan have free-floating rationales and are not the brain children of any particular authors. I do not mean to suggest that this portrait of the gods is the product of conscious human creation. No one sat down and decided, let's believe in a supreme god, surround him, her, with some subordinate beings, and postulate an inferior evil being on whom we can blame evil. Rather, this view tends to evolve over time, because it is the most reasonable and satisfying conclusion from the available religious culture, pages 25 and 26. Stark's footnote on this passage is not to be missed. Nor am I prepared to deny that this evolution reflects progressive human discovery of the truth. Ah, that's the ticket. The story doesn't just get better, it happens to get closer to the truth. A lucky break? Maybe not. Wouldn't a really good God arrange things that way? Maybe, but the fact that dramatic considerations so conveniently dictate the details of the story does provide an explanation of why the details are what they are that rivals the traditional supposition that they are simply the God's honest truth. 4. A God You Can Talk To. The Pope traditionally prays for peace every Easter, and the fact that it has never had any effect whatsoever in preventing or ending a war never deters him. What goes through the Pope's mind after being rejected all the time? Does God have it in for him? Andy Rooney. Sincerely, Andy Rooney. Whatever we may think of Stark's professed agnosticism on this score, surely he is right about the main shortcoming of highly abstract conceptions of God. Because divine essences are incapable of exchanges, they may present mysteries, but they pose no tactical questions and thus prompt no effort to discover terms of exchange, page 16. Who can be loyal to a god who cannot be asked for anything? It doesn't have to be manna from heaven, as the comedian Emo Phillips once said, "When I was a child, I used to pray to God for a bicycle. But then I realized that God doesn't work in that way. So I stole a bike and prayed for forgiveness." And as Stark observes, rewards are always in limited supply, and some are entirely unavailable. At least they are not available here and now through conventional means, page 17. A key marketing problem for religions, then, is how to entice the customer to wait. Recovery from cancer is rather minor compared with everlasting life, but perhaps the most significant aspect of otherworldly rewards is that the realization of these rewards is postponed, often until after death. Consequently, in pursuit of otherworldly rewards, humans will accept an extended exchange relationship with gods. That is, humans will make periodic payments over a substantial length of time, often until death, page 19. What can be done to keep people making their payments? Miraculous cures and prayed-for reversals of fortune go a long way, of course, by providing evidence of benefits received in this world by oneself or others, but even in their absence, there are design features that pay for themselves handily. The most interesting is the price inversion effect, described by Stark and Fink, 2000. The answer can be found in elementary economics. Price is only one factor in any exchange. Quality is the other, and combined, they yield an estimate of value. Herein lies the secret of the strength of higher-tension religious groups. Despite being expensive, they offer greater value. Indeed, they are able to do so because they are expensive, page 145. Tension refers to the degree of distinctiveness, separation, and antagonism between a religious group and the outside world, page 143. So, in a spectrum from low to high, large established churches are low tension, and sects and cults are high tension. An expensive religion is one that is high in material, social, and psychic costs of belonging. It doesn't just cost time spent on religious duties and money in the collection plate. Belonging can incur a loss of social standing and actually exacerbate, not ameliorate, one's anxiety and suffering. But you get what you pay for. Unlike the heathen, you get saved for eternity. To the extent that one is motivated by religious value, one must prefer a higher-priced supplier. Not only do more expensive religious groups offer more valuable product, but in doing so, they generate levels of commitment needed to maximize individual levels of confidence in the religion, in the truth of the fundamental doctrines, in the efficacy of its practices, and in the certainty of its otherworldly promises, pages 146 and 147. The more you have invested in your religion, the more you will be motivated to protect that investment. Stark and Fink are not alone in seeing that costliness can sometimes make good economic sense. For instance, the evolutionary economists Samuel Bowles and Herbert Gintis, 1998-2001, have developed formal models of communities that foster pro-social norms, cultural traits governing actions that affect the well-being of others, but that cannot be regulated by costlessly enforceable contracts, 2001, page 345. Their models show that these pro-social effects depend on low-cost access to information about other community members, as well as the tendency to favor interactions with group members, and restrict migration in and out, points that Stark and Fink make as well. The high entry and exit costs are as crucial to the survival of such arrangements as the membrane surrounding a cell. Self-maintenance is costly, and is made more efficient by a strict distinction between me and the rest of the world, in the case of a cell, or between us and them, in the case of a community. The work by Bowles and Gintis doesn't just provide formal support for some of the propositions defended by Stark and Fink. It shows that the deplorable xenophobia found in high-tension religious communities is not a specifically religious feature. Xenophobia, they argue, is the price any community or group must pay for a high level of internal trust and harmony. And moreover, it is a price we may in the end decide we have to be willing to pay. Far from being vestigial anachronisms, we think communities may become more rather than less important in the nexus of governance structures in the years to come, since communities may claim some success in addressing governance problems not amenable to market or state solution. Bowles and Gintis, 2001, page 364. Stark and Fink's applications of rational choice theory to many of the trends and disparities observable in American religious denominations are not yet proven, and have spirited detractors, but they are certainly worth further research. And the implications of some of their propositions are provocative indeed. For instance, Proposition 76. Even where competition is limited, religious firms can generate high levels of participation to the extent that the firms serve as the primary organizational vehicles for social conflict. Conversely, if religious firms become significantly less important as vehicles for social conflict, they will be correspondingly less able to generate commitment, page 202. In other words, expect religious firms to exploit and exacerbate social conflict whenever possible, since it is a way of generating business. This can be good, Polish Catholic resistance to communism, or bad, the interminable conflict in Ireland. Detractors will say we already know this about religions, but the claim that this is a systematic feature which follows from other features and interacts with still others in ways that are predictable is, if true, just the sort of fact we are going to want to understand deeply as we deal with social conflicts in the future. When religious leaders and their critics, both inside and outside their religions, consider possible reforms and improvements, they are setting themselves up whether they like it or not, to be mimetic engineers, tinkering with the designs they have been bequeathed by tradition in order to adjust the observable effects. And some of the most telling observations in Stark and Fink's book are their biting criticisms of well-intentioned reforms that have backfired. Are they right about the principal reason for the precipitous decline in Catholics seeking a vocation in the Church after Vatican II? Previously, the Catholic Church had taught that priests and the religious, nuns and monks, were in a superior state of holiness. Now, despite their vows, they were just like everyone else, page 177. The laity had gained some of the privileges of the priesthood without shouldering the burden of celibacy or a direct accountability to the church hierarchy. For many, the priesthood was no longer a good deal, following the renewal efforts of Vatican II, page 185. Or are they wrong? The only way to find out is to do the research. Unpalatability is not a reliable sign of falsehood, and the pious homilies that often guided earlier reformers need to be confirmed, disconfirmed, or else ignored. The stakes are too high for well-meant amateur blundering. As earlier in my discussions of the work of Boyer, Wilson, and others, I am not declaring a verdict on the soundness or conclusiveness of any of this work, but only introducing what I take to be examples of the work that needs to be taken seriously from now on, and either firmly and fairly refuted or, however begrudgingly, acknowledged for its genuine contributions to our understanding. In the case of Stark's refreshingly candid vision, I myself have deep misgivings, some of which will emerge when we turn to some of the complications that he so resolutely sets aside. Stark and Fink express their fundamental attitude well when they disparage Don Cupid's After God, The Future of Religion, 1997, which endorses a brand of religion from which all traces of the supernatural have been removed. But why would a religion without God have a future? Cupid's prescription strikes us as rather like expecting people to continue to buy soccer tickets and gather in the stands to watch players who, for lack of a ball, just stand around. If there are no supernatural beings, then there are no miracles. There is no salvation. Prayer is pointless. The commandments are but ancient wisdom, and death is the end. In which case, the rational person would have nothing to do with church, or, more accurately, a rational person would have nothing to do with a church like that, page 146. Strong language, but they must recognize that Cupid and the others who have turned away from their vision of God the deal-maker were well aware of its attractions and must have had their reasons, articulated or not, for resisting it so artfully for so long. What can be said in favor of the God-as-essence path, or rather paths, since there have been many different ways of trying to conceive of God in less anthropomorphic terms? I think the key can be found in some of Stark and Fink's own observations. Given the fact that religion is risky goods and that people often can increase their flow of immediate benefits through religious inactivity, it seems unlikely that any amount of pluralism and vigorous marketing can ever achieve anything close to total market penetration. The proportion of Americans who actually belong to a specific church congregation, as opposed to naming a religious preference when asked, has hovered around 65% for many decades, showing no tendency to respond even to major economic cycles, page 257. It will be interesting to try to learn more about the 35% who were just not cut out for church, as well as the proportion of those churchgoers who are not cut out for high-tension, expensive religions of the sort Stark favors. They exist all over the world. According to Stark and Fink, there are godless religions, but their followings are restricted to small elites, as in the case of the elite forms of Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism, page 290N. The attractions of Unitarianism, Episcopalianism, and Reformed Judaism are not restricted to the Abrahamic traditions, and if the elites find that they just cannot bring themselves to believe they have experienced long and satisfying exchange relations with God, why do they persist with something they call religion at all? Chapter 7. The human proclivity for groupishness is less calculated and prudential than it appears in some economic models, but also more complicated than the evolved herding instinct of some animals. What complicates the picture is human language and culture. and the perspective of memes permits us to comprehend how the phenomena of human allegiance are influenced by a mixture of free-floating and well-tethered rationales. We can make progress by acknowledging that submission to a religion need not be cast as a deliberate economic decision, while also recognizing the analytic and predictive power of the perspective that views religions as designed systems competing in a dynamic marketplace for adherence with different needs and tastes. Chapter 8. The stewardship of religious ideas creates a powerful phenomenon, belief in belief, which radically transforms the content of the underlying beliefs, making rational investigation of them difficult, if not impossible. Chapter 8. Belief in Belief. 1. You better believe it. I think God honors the fact that I want to believe in Him, whether I feel sure or not. Anonymous informant quoted by Alan Wolfe in The Transformation of American Religion. The proof that the devil exists, acts, and succeeds is precisely that we no longer believe in him. Denis de Rougemont, The Devil's Share. At the end of Chapter 1, I promised to return to Hume's question in his Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, the question of whether we have good reasons for believing in God, and in this chapter, I will keep that promise. The preceding chapters have laid some new foundations for this inquiry, but also uncovered some problems besetting it that need to be addressed before any effective confrontation between theism and atheism can take place. Once our ancestors became reflective and hyper-reflective about their own beliefs and thus appointed themselves stewards of the beliefs they thought most important, the phenomenon of believing in belief became a salient social force in its own right, sometimes eclipsing the lower-order phenomena that were its object.